Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries. This morning from Hong Kong, we have the current advisor to Animoca Brands and the co-founder and CEO of Everest Ventures Group joining us today. Please welcome Alan Ng. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, man.
And how are things with you this morning in Hong Kong?
Yeah, everything's good. Yeah, except my daughter like woke me up too early.
Alan, let's jump into the first question here, shall we?
Sure, sounds good. Yeah.
So Alan, tell me about yourself and your background, and really how it led you to the path of starting EVG or Everest Ventures Group.
Okay, cool. So I started my background actually not in finance. As you know, most of the people probably in Hong Kong started in finance. So I actually started in startup. So I started doing startups in college, and so two companies, and then accidentally I got into finance later on, got recruited to BuySide, and then joined a private equity group in Hong Kong to help them set up the TMT practice and look after the tech investment. And then throughout the process, I accidentally also stumbled upon crypto in 2017. And then, I was doing a lot of ICO deals myself, and I was really intrigued, got involved with some of the biggest projects at the time. And then later on in late 2018, I decided to left the PE firm and just start EVG by myself. But EVG is actually not a fund. It's just a holding company like Animoca Brands or like DCG to a certain degree. We are a venture studio which incubate companies and also invest from our balance sheets into startups as well.
So then, Alan, what does EVG actually do? Is it then a venture builder, venture capital fund? What is it?
Yeah, it's basically a venture builder slash venture investment hybrid. So it's very simple. We don't have like an LP GP structure like most of the funds. We're just a holding company, and we built company from ground up, from ideation stage, staffing the CEOs, finding the co-founder team, and then also like building product, etc. with in-house, like for example, we have over 150 in-house engineers that build products. We have a large middle office like ByteDance, right, to also support, all the currently about 9 incubated companies so far. And we have also invested into about 40 companies so far as a minority investors. So it's pretty flexible. It's basically just my flagship for everything venture building and venture investment. So currently we have about 250 staff globally and across a few major areas of operation. So we've incubated companies under Everest FinTech Group, which has like KikiTray, which is a Socialfy project, and also with Aspen Digital, which is asset management platform tailor-made for the mainstream private wealth clients. And then on the other side, on the content, Everest Culture Lab, we have gaming incubation platforms that focus more on GameFi and open metaverse. We have also a joint venture with one of the largest entertainment company here in Asia to produce, which is an NFT studio producing like NFT series using cinematic IPs and also cinematic storytelling approach, et cetera. We have a project with New York called Live Art, which is focusing more on the NFT infrastructure for art. The third part will be the Everest Emerging Market Group, which is basically our operation in Africa. And with 3 companies there, we incubated together with Transient Holding, which is the largest technology conglomerate in Africa. They own like over 50% market share in Africa. And also, obviously, there's the Everest Capital Group, which we invest into companies and deals, right?
So how I see this is kind of you split across 4 to 5 different, specific divisions. And given this, what have been some of your most not only exciting investments, but incubations till date?
Yeah, I think you know, it's a little bit like asking me to pick my favorite kid to a certain degree. but I think many of them has really unique thesis, right? And all of them are tackling different industry. A lot of them, honestly, like very daring experiments that we're doing here. For example, take Aspen Digital for an example, you know, which is positioned also in Hong Kong as a headquarter. We started because historically I was connected to a lot of like you know, family office here, and then a lot of them come to me for advice or due diligence on crypto related opportunities. And there's a lot of pain point, you know, from education to the friction of Web3 to you know, the fact that, you know, it's so hard for them, you know, to just very quickly grab that. You know, after all, they don't have the time, you know, 5 hours, 4 hours, 3 hours a day to go into Twitter or Discord or just absorb, you know, YouTube tutorials. So that's why, you know, one of the key theses there was like, how do we create this really simple, almost like private banking experience that is tailor-made for the mainstream high net worth and the mainstream family offices. So yeah, it sounds boring, but you know, from a product engineering perspective, there is so much you need to do to make things really simple, right? Like Warren Buffett said, like it's much harder to make things any fool can make things complicated, but it's really hard to make things simpler. And so for example, I think, you know, I consider that actually is a very interesting experiment I have so far. Is like, how do you translate something Web3 that's much more technical into something that is much more like a normie language for the mainstream?
So with Aspen Digital, you guys basically saw a pain point in the market and said, hey, there's no solution for it out there. What can we do to make a solution?
Correctly. Correct. So that's the normal approach we have when it comes to incubation. We won't just sit there and say, you know what, what's hot this year? Let's do something that's hot, right? I think that is a wrong approach, because the industry has too many just, you know, honestly, like hypes, right? A lot of model is still not proven yet. You know, I like to go back to the more like traditional startup, you know, method. It's like you find a pain point, something that's so painful for the users, and then and you work backward. You try to build MVP, you try to launch it, you try to see whether how customer respond from it. You try to find the best like target demographic to build a product market fit. So I really don't consider like building a Web3 business, like, you know, from my perspective, that different from building any type of business. I think the core principle of entrepreneurship, you know, is still pretty much the same. And I think if today, you know, like for example, if Elon Musk or Jack Dorsey quit their job and focus on blockchain fully, they're still going to be great entrepreneurs. It won't be, you know, there won't be differences, because I think after all, it's just about building a business. Yes, there may be some more, you know, principle to be applied in Web3, such as, for example, if you're building a protocol, then you need to take into considerations of like decentralization and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, for the rest, I think it's, you know, pretty much the same. It's about solving pain points, giving value to the user, and extracting a proportion of those value for a business.
So Alan, you just mentioned that the industry is very overhyped. Then how does someone go about looking for high quality projects? How do you go about it?
Right, that's a great question. I think high quality project, well, I think it's a little bit different for each type of business model, right? When you're evaluating, let's say, NFT project is quite different from evaluating, let's say, you know, running fintech infrastructure, and it's different from obviously running a protocol business, right? So I think it's we're lucky that we had success in, let's say, all three of them, right? On the fintech side, we are backers of like Kraken or Dynamo, which is incredibly successful fintech projects, Luca in the US, right? Pushing the front of institutionalizations. And then on the NFT side, we got companies like Animoca, et cetera, Sandbox, and Immutable, And then, you know, and then also on the protocol level, we're already investing in a project like Flow, for example, right? So I think all of them are slightly different, because simply because like what kind of entrepreneur it may require, and also the ingredient you require are a little bit different. But I think one common thing, you know, the common component among all of them is that, you know, you need a really good team, right? But a good team tailor-made for each of those needs, right? I'm not sure if that sounds logical, it makes sense for you. So for example, in the NFT, like for example, all three of them need to be very good, you know, have a very strong product sense. All three of them may need to have a very strong growth capability, like how to hack growth in the early days, because in the early days, you're not going to have hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, how to hack growth. And all three of them need to be able to have very strong managerial skill set as well, because, you know, especially in crypto, a lot of teams are working remotely as well. So, you know, you need to be really good, just business manager and team managers or team leaders to keep people in place. So I think those are certain level of, I would say, the common thresholds that you're looking at. And it's quite similar to a lot of the traditional venture capital. But there's also a lot of some component a little bit different. For example, like if you're running a protocol, then, you know, our question will be more as in how do you are going to, you know, build the ecosystem around you, because running a protocol is pretty much similar to building a country. So how to attract, you know, other, you know, ecosystem investor, how to attract token holders, how do you create a strong economy, and before you have it, how to fake it until you make it, right? So I think there is so much techniques that involved, and how to attract developers, right? And so I think there's, you know, certain set of things that are more, you know, would have a higher emphasis in a protocol business. And but in the contrary, if you look at, for example, like running a fintech infrastructure, right? You know, having a finance background would be really helpful, because, you know, then because you'll probably be dealing with numbers a lot, you'll be dealing with conversion funnels a lot, you're dealing with much more traditional like CAC and LTV a lot, right? And you need a very strong financial sense of financial products. So I think all of them could be slightly different, but, you know, because we invest in much more early in a stage, that means the clarity of the project are much lower. So we focus a lot more on the team and their early track records of achieving something with very little resources, right? So I think, you know, venture capital to a certain degree is about how do we extract the maximum amount of data from how to extract, you know, maximum amount of insights from very minimal data you have, especially in early investing. So I think, you know, one of those things that we really focus on is going back to the team, because honestly, the business plan always changes, right? Even for the brightest business, it has changed so much. And but for team, there's always some patterns you can see.
So given the deep insights you have in Asian markets, how do you see developer talent across Asia?
Oh, I think it's really strong. I think a lot of Asian projects often sell short of themselves. When it comes to comparing, you know, with Western project, and somehow we get this like the elephant in the room is a lot of people think a Western project is, you know, just inherently better than an Asian project. And I can understand from a historical standpoint that, yeah, there are a lot of Asian projects that failed, right? But I can also, you know, argue that, you know, actually a lot of Asian projects has made it to a certain level, right? And honestly, we are much more advanced in terms of those trial and errors and experiments so far in the whole crypto market. And if you know, back in the days, like for example, for 2017 cycles and 2018 cycle, Asia probably dominated like 80% of the flow for all the of the transactions. And if you look at the top 100 coins back then, like over probably 60% were Asian projects, right? So I think Asian engineers are really, really strong, especially the Chinese and the Korean. I think those are really, really strong. And those are very daring as well. They come with new ideas. They execute on them really quickly. And, you know, project like Stepin, for example, like Jerry is amazing founder. And, you know, he was extremely good product sense. who, you know, is also, you know, a fierce competitor and executor. So I think there's a lot of great projects like that. And I think, you know, AZ kind of also led the whole trial of play to earn. You know, I'm not saying that play to earn might be, you know, the most sustainable model moving forward. But, you know, what I try to argue is, like, actually, if you look at the facts, it's a lot of Asian teams are really, really strong, fundamentally sound. They're really daring. They know how to execute and test on an idea really fast. And I simply just, you know, I like Asian teams, honestly. And yeah.
As you mentioned, when it comes to the West compared to the East here, there seems to be more when it comes to the iterative processes engineers use within, let's say, China, and when it comes to churning out products. Can you tell us more about this or speak more to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you used the, you know, your word is extremely accurate, like iterative process, which I think is the most important thing when it comes to doing a startup. It's almost like evolutions, right? You just need different version of yourself and you need to iterate them really fast. And whoever iterates faster is gonna in the end win the market regardless of your size. Because I think one thing that can really make up for resources is speed, right? And I think if even look at traditional, like ByteDance was a great example of that, right? They incubated TikTok, which started honestly years after Facebook. And Facebook by then already have 1 billion+ users and is already a listed company, have tons more resources than they do, and already acquire like company like WhatsApp and also like Instagram. So technically they have a head start on a lot of things, but TikTok just came up nowhere and iterated much faster with their, you know, a lot of new innovations on their recommendation engines, on their, you know, short video feeds, etc., and in their new operation models. So I think there's not just product, there's a lot of new trials as well going on. And Asian engineers is usually, you know, to be completely frank, they work much longer hours than other teams. And also, you know, because all of them has less funding as well, they don't have the luxury of saying that, hey, let's push a, you know, a version of product, you know, once per month or once per 2 months, right? Like Jerry once told me from Stepan, like he iterate in the first 3 months, they iterate once per week. So they're always a new version each and every week, right? So the speed of iteration is so different, right? By the time a counterparty has a version in a month, they already have 4 versions, right? And then those like incremental differences, each of the version might seems like a more incremental differences, but you know, once you compound it, you know, over, let's say, a 12-week cycle, 18-week cycle, you know, a half-year cycle, you know, things are all of a sudden it become a very big significant differences between projects. And, you know, the competitive advantage they have is much, much bigger. So I think it's really the speed is the key to iterations. And also, I think iterations is also about listening to users and following users, right? One of the principles we have in the firm is that, you know, it's great to have a workshop session to brainstorm ideas to talk through among executive, but nothing is as important as, you know, going to your users, listen to them, ask them whether they need it. I always you have this like examples, like for example, if you have an idea to build, let's say a new type of vending machine selling orange juice or orange in MTR or in Metro, what you should do really first is you should just get a basket, buy a basket of, you know, orange or orange juice, stand there in different MTR station, try to sell them, you know, in a traditional manner way, because who knows, maybe your audience doesn't like orange juice in the morning when they commute, maybe they want coffees, right? So then building, it's not about building the vending machine anymore, it's about whether that is a real demand for them. And I think a lot of those, in our industry currently, I think currently the user demand are still not very well addressed. We are still much more ideal. Sometimes the founder a lot more, you know, stay much more on the, you know, ideology level. They're, you know, sometimes like, you know, fantasizing about certain demands. But I think testing demands is a lot more important than just like trying to workshop it or write the best PowerPoint or try to convince a VC. You know, I think a lot of founders and projects spend too much time trying to convince an investor. They should really spend a lot more time trying to convince a user. And I think all those are related to the iterative process you're talking about. And so I think so far the Asian engineers or Asian teams has done an amazing job, especially I think on the decentralized application level, they've done such an amazing job. In terms of like testing all the needs and iterating the product fast enough to catch up with those.
So Alan, I want to take a turn in the conversation and look at the market from a high level here. How have high startup multiples, which have led to overvaluation, affected the Web 3.0 industry in your eyes?
Yeah, so I think the high valuation or bubble, right? Let's call it bubble, right? I think is a double-edged sword, right? Is not, I think some people would think is good, right? Some people would think it's bad, right? But I think it's really a little bit mixed. So from a macro perspective, the high valuation and speculation, the speculative activities of the industry did attract talent, capital, attentions that's required for the evolution of the industry. For example, I was attracted by, you know, the market cap, the also the activities, you know, the projects, etc. in 2017, despite knowing at the time that, you know, there's obviously was a huge bubble, right? And similarly, in the recent cycles in 2020, it attracted a new batch of talent, new batch of capital, a new batch of, you know, dreamers to join the industry, which is great because, you know, what you're portraying is, you know, everyone wants to be in a loud, you know, fun party, right? With a lot of activity going on. And that's what capital market does for us, right? The bad thing is, on the other side, is actually a problem for a lot of the projects as well, because a lot of projects that builds with the incredibly high valuations, that means you're priced at almost on a price to dream ratio. It depends on how big your story is, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. So then your expectation is so high of you, and it's very hard for you to catch up to that level of standard. And then it will often result in disappointment, and it will result in, you know, the team's morale to catch up, to really stand up to that dream, and et cetera, et cetera. And also it has makes it much more difficult for a lot of growth stage or later stage investor to invest in those projects, because technically even in early stage, you're already priced it at a growth stage valuation. You're already, when you, let's say, have like less than 10 million revenue, some of them are even priced at billions of valuations. It's very hard. Like basically you have exhausted all the growth potentials into your valuation already for the next less than 3 years. So it makes it much more difficult for the team, the entrepreneurs, to execute on them. And however, they will often get this, like, and also it gives them a mis or wrong perception that this will forever goes on, right? So I think it's sometimes could hurt projects, you know, from an operational standpoint, and it can hurt investors as well, because especially when there is so much investor, like last cycle, you see a lot of like hedge funds, a lot of sovereign funds. You also see, for example, like very big name institutions that was actually a lot more like an asset manager than investors. They're just deploying crazy, and they're pricing projects crazy, and it makes it so difficult for the industry to evolve. So I think there's good and there's bad, right? It depends how you see it, and whether you can keep a level-headed approach to deal with all of that.
And when it came to the Luna crash, which was one of the leading factors in driving the bear market, what really happened there in your eyes?
Yeah, so funny that we were actually offered to invest in the pre-sale of Luna back in the days. I remember I was traveling to Korea, and Do Kwon and the team, you know, took me out for a barbecue, and they said, like, oh, we really like you. Here's 2 million allocations. And oh, honestly, if I, you know, in the end, I give it to another famous fund. But one of the reasons we passed back then is actually, you know, very, very simple. You know, one of my analysts was an econ major, right? We look at a paper, we look at a model. And then I remember that really smart analyst told me, like, you know, this is more like a perpetual energy machine. And the model, simply the coin would not be stable, right? There's no way it could be stable, right? And it won't, it won't be able to survive tests, right? So that's why at the time we feel like, oh, this might be, maybe too difficult to maintain, right? So we passed on the project. But also, it's funny that the fund who took up my allocation, my friend, he made shit tons of money over the last cycle or so, selling Nunes, right, before it crashed, right? So you know, sometimes this is like the industry, right? People have the daring experiments. And some people believe in it, some people don't. And but in the end, sustainability and the fundamental will always catch up with you. And I think they're unlucky that, if let's say they build into a, let's say 100 times of today's size, then Luna might be really just, would have a better sustainability. But unfortunately, the early days track record and also the so-called stability of their stablecoin UST was much more supported just by the cash flows from the foundations on the Luna side. So it's, to be exact, it's much more like a central government or central bank, manipulation approach of trying to control the stability of something. But you are one central bank, one foundation versus the whole world of traders and whole world of the free markets. So, as long as it's one mistake or as long as you have one moment of weakness, people are going to attack you. And simply that, despite you have $1 billion worth of Bitcoin or $2 billion worth of cash, whatever, is not, there's always an infinite number that you can subsidize, right? And also if you look at like Anchorage at the point, it was like 20% in guaranteed return on their yield, right? It was obviously, I think this goes back to finance 101, like it's always risk and reward. When you're paying out 20% and you have no way, and out of those 20%, maybe let's say only 5% is really sustainable, 15% is subsidized. Then, when the Luna price crashed, then you no longer have the capital available to subsidize it. So it's more like basic finance 101, really, I think what happened. I don't think is necessarily a scam, or I think a lot of people is really angry. A lot of people feel like they're the founders did certain thing unethical and stuff like that. I personally don't think so. I think it's just a project that fundamentally it just fails to catch up. With the speed of its building, it couldn't catch up with the story it's portraying, and also the size it's managing is a little bit over itself. And the experiment fell. And by definition, I think startups are like experiments, right? So failure is part of the process. Failure is important for the industry to iterate. So I'm not trying to over decode it as in, oh, is this something unethical here? But I just think the project, like from a fundamental design perspective, is flaws, right? And those flaws were exploited by traders or hedge funds or whoever that might be, and then result in a really unfortunate consequence. And I guess a lot of retail lost monies. I think that was one of the more unfortunate ends. But honestly, project like that is going to continue. We're going to continue to see the next Luna, honestly.
And when you say seeing the next Luna, that's actually quite concerning. Why do you think that? Do you not think the industry's kind of learned from this?
No. So one thing doesn't change is from the retail end, I think it's funny. I think the investors, they can't just point a finger completely at the projects. Over time, even if you look at the world today, there's a lot of people like speculating on meme stocks, right? Stocks that absolutely don't have the fundamentals. Some of those stocks are crazily speculated. And the retails continue to do so. So I think in the end it's just the speculative nature of the human nature of being, that likes speculations. A lot of people know they're gambling, but I think a lot of people is like trying to mix up. When they're gambling, they feel like they're investing. They're trying to come up with like different terms for the action they do. So I think it's like as long as that human nature continues, I think there's always gonna be the next crypto project that resulted in the losses of many people, and it's similar to stock market, similar to Evergrande bond, right? I think it doesn't, it really draw no differences from one asset class to another. It's just people love to gamble, right? And also projects are going to continue to fail, right? I also don't think, you know, you can blame completely sometimes on the project or the company or et cetera, who fails, because, you know, well, business is one of those things, is a constant struggle, right? Like, you know, so many great companies, you know, if they don't really put their heart and soul into it, they could fail too. Facebook could fail too, right? With so many people attacking them, despite how big they are or how much market share they are, you know, Facebook could fail too, right? Just like Kodak, just like many other companies before them. So I think it's more like a market phenomenon, right? Of what's going on. I think a lot more people just feels like, because Dukan at the time, they probably was too aggressive in terms of his PR or his you know, his attitude was a little bit cocky and et cetera, et cetera. So I think it backfired a little bit. If he were like, let's say, a lot humbler, then maybe there's going to be less people pointing finger at him today. But you know, honestly, I think as an investor or as a builder, like, we always have this humility and knowing that, you know what, this is an experiment we're doing. There's a small chance it will succeed. It's a high chance it will fail, right? And you also need to communicate that, you know, honestly with your investor and users too.
And Alan, to really wrap up our call with our last question for the day, what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you've had so far in life?
Yeah. So my biggest piece of advice, it might not be suitable for everyone, because everyone might have, you know, different people might have different aspirations and how they position themselves. But I think if you're more so on the venture side of things, I think you should really, especially if you are currently in Web2 or in mainstream industry like finance and you want to join Web3, one of the biggest pieces of advice is you should join a project and learn from a project or from a day-to-day, you know, operational perspective than, you know, trying to, let's say, join a fund to be a venture capitalist right away, or to be a trader right away, or to be investor right away. So the example I would use here is, like, let's say 20 years ago, you're very bullish about China or Chinese internet. Of course, you can switch from, let's say, your current job to, let's say, to the China desk of China coverage desk to cover the China stocks or write about the listed company or interview the CEOs. But your level of understandings will be very different than you just, like, you know, really quit your job and go to Alibaba or go join an internet company in China. That will allow you to see much more in from both operational level, from the ground level, from actually how those business was built, what's the struggle, and et cetera, than, you know, joining, let's say, their quarterly earning report and, you know, talking, interviewing management, because the whatever they're telling you is much more the results. You don't really see the process. And so I think that will be very key advice. And it's also correlated to my career as well. I think one thing that made me maybe as a good venture investor is also because the fact that I used to start and run ventures. So I understand the struggles of, you know, how often things could fail, how difficult it is to iterate things, and terms like pivoting, you know, what does that really mean? Or product market fit, what does that really mean, right? So it's less, a lot more practical than I would say, like more on the theory level, that give me insights about, you know, how to identify a good team, how to identify good opportunities, how to make assessment of projects, and et cetera, et cetera. And also, I think partially why EVG has succeeded in many, like, of the early investment we did that has become unicorns, right? Out of the 40 investments we make, 7 of them has become unicorns, right? And it also, there's obviously luck is a big part of that, but also I think, you know, it's about that we are able to, as one entrepreneur to another, we understand a lot of time, you know, the thesis they are working on, the team structure they're putting up together to cater for that, and how do they see challenges and what kind of resources they will need to overcome all of those, right? So I think, you know, having this, like, more founder operator perspective really helps when it comes to doing
investment. But on the other way around, I can't say the same, right? Like if you're an amazing investor, it doesn't guarantee you a very good operator, right? And if you look at the world, let's say Neil Shen, which is someone I respect deeply, the founder of Sequoia China, he was the CFO of Ctrip. He was the co-founder of Ctrip. He was an amazing, amazing operator. Peter Thiel, right? Another very iconic investors. He was also an operator. He founded PayPal, right? So I do think that, you know, being an engineer or being an operator, it could be the most, you know, valuable journey you could embark on if you want to join Web3, right?
Alan, some really solid points. And for people who are interested in maybe catching a cup of coffee with you in person or maybe having a Zoom call with you, what would be the best point of contact?
Yeah, so obviously you have my Telegram, so feel free to ask them to connect me on Telegram. Like I'm not doing as much like, you know, in-person meeting, you know, these days due to COVID and everything, but you know, I can definitely check them up if there are things I can help. Feel free to connect them with me on Telegram. Yeah,
Alan, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem, man. Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by PyTone, an Asian-based open source enterprise software company. PyTone offers a suite of software applications and infrastructure services to scholars and universities.